Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to A Time for Justice. A Time for Justice is a show on the Elevated Places Network. And my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad. I'm an attorney, and this show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impact these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. All too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. Let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of our people. And tonight we have a wonderful show talking about just that, equitable solutions which are in the best interest of the people. And we are taught that by uniting our efforts, we are attempting tonight to protect the Black family. And this is what we want to encourage, the uniting of our efforts to protect the Black family. So we have some wonderful, wonderful special guests. And we're going to be talking about an article that appeared on the, it was a cover page article of the Final Call newspaper, and it was entitled, Child Protective Service Agencies Are Tearing Black Families Apart, Advocates Warn. And it was written by our brother Michael Z. Muhammad. And again, that's the September 21st. Article and edition of the Final Call, and I do suggest that everyone read and go find that article because it's so beautiful and it's so true and it's so helpful in today's time when we have to unite to protect Black families. So tonight, our guests are going to be some of the renowned workers in the community and very educated, experienced, very knowledgeable about this subject. So let me go ahead by starting. I want to introduce our, and she's new to the Elevated Places, a beautiful sister. Her name is Sandera Mallory. And Sandera actually comes from the child welfare system. She was a family-based safety services supervisor in the Texas Department of Family Protective Services from 1998 until 2013. Sandera is she's been a practitioner and trainer at the Graduate School of Social Work in Houston, Texas, and she's worked with CPS Training Institute, so she has over 36 years of experience in this system. After retiring, she is now the owner of a Mallory Associates Counseling and Consultants. She also engages in group therapy. Sister Sandera is so dear and near to our hearts. She is a member of the National Association of Black Social Workers, which is a groundbreaking, a very historical group of black social workers who have, you know, really given us so much assistance participating in the national agenda for the Million Man March on issues of knowledge. And so, you know, she has a lot that she brings to the table, but I'm going to go ahead and open up her mic and greet her, Sister Sandera Mallory. Let's see, Sister Sandera. Okay.
Hotep.
Yes, ma'am. Hotep to you. Yes, ma'am.
I bring you greetings on behalf of the Association of Black Social Workers, as well as the Houston community, as we fight for children and their needs.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. She is a freedom fighter. And so next, I want to bring up a frequent contributor to A Time for Justice. She always calls us. She always supports us. But she is actually also a parent advocate and a very knowledgeable person in the area of child welfare. So this is Sister Marguerite Muhammad, who entered the Nation of Islam in Los Angeles in the 1980s. She actually moved to Phoenix and became a secretary back in 1982. She became a secretary for Brother Jibril Muhammad and the minister on his visits. Oh, and sometimes the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan when he would visit. And she and her husband have 12 years of foster care experience, and she's fostered her own grandchildren. She has stepchildren, biological children, with 25 grandchildren, and she became a parent advocate and community activist while working with the Black Mothers Forum in Phoenix, Arizona. So again, Sister Marguerite, she and her husband have 12 years, as I said, of foster care experience, and that's something she brings to the table. This sister is a fighter, as we, many of us know. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Marguerite.
Wa alaikum salam. All praises due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for taking out your time to come and talk to our audience tonight. And also, we have Dr. Deborah Green, and Dr. Green has been on the show before, and we're so thankful that she's taken out time to share with us again. Dr. Green, she actually wrote a dissertation on exploring teacher strategies to improve learning outcomes for students at risk of exclusionary discipline, which is something that's very much related to this CPS's penal and racial profiling system. Dr. Green, she's a certified mediator. She's a certified master social worker. You know, she's certified criminal justice specialist. She's president of the National Black Child Development Institute here in Houston, Texas. She is on the secretary of the Lighthouse, Inc. Board of Directors. That's a local church. And she is a professional facilitator, trainer, community activist, and educational consultant. And Dr. Green also brings with her extensive experience as a employee of the child welfare system, as she worked actually in the Houston Children's Protective Services for years. And finally, I want to introduce our brother, because our brother is just a dynamic attorney, and I just really appreciate this brother and his heart and his hard work. Brother John Muhammad, who is a practicing attorney since 2001. And over the years, Brother Deshaun, and I want to make this clear, somebody please mute your phones if we got a little background. I'm not sure who it is, but if we can mute our phones for a moment, we're going to do a little problem. I'm going to try to see if we can see what's going on. But anyway, Brother Deshaun Muhammad, as I said, he has been a practicing attorney since 2001. And over the years, he's practiced law all over the state of Tennessee. He's a former Chancery Court Special Master for Shelby County, Tennessee. He's tried both criminal and civil cases. Now, he has a passion for cases involving children and families, and I think it's very, very interesting. Brother Deshaun has been an attorney for the Tennessee Department of Children's Services, which is a CPS agency in the state of Tennessee. And since that time, he has represented countless children and families in the court system in cases involving delinquency, child abuse, custody, and all aspects of family law. He is a husband and father of a toddler. He's a Chicago native. Brother Deshaun graduated from law school at Drake University, and he actually works at the law office of Juan Williams in South Haven, Mississippi. So again, I would like to welcome Brother Deshaun. Brother Deshaun?
Yes, ma'am. As-salamu alaykum.
Yeah. Wa alaykum salam, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, ma'am. Good to hear from you. And good to be on a panel with such experienced guests.
Yes, sir. Thank you. The pleasure is ours, and we are so happy to have you here. And, you know, as I said, I mean, you all are family. And also, we have an organization called the Coalition for the Preservation of the Black Family. And I have to say that is one of this issue of child protective services stealing and kidnapping our children. They call it legal kidnapping. The final call talked about how our black families are under siege. You know, this is an issue that we really want to pour our hearts into, because as times are getting more and more crucial in the world we live in, we want to make sure our families know how to protect their children. Now, again, this story in the final call, it came to light because of the sister, Miss Mercado, whose child was actually taken by gunpoint. And many of us saw that because they took a video of that. And this young lady, she and her partner, their child was taken at gunpoint in Manatee County by the sheriff's deputies. And we also saw a lot of little white females surrounding, and this was a newborn. And this incident, as many of us have heard, these facts are pretty familiar. See, you know, her child, her oldest son was 13 months old, and he sought medical assistance. You know, the hospital said something about, did they take some vitamin B shots? And this is where an investigation, if we can call it that, the assault and the targeting of her family began. And it was so bad that later on they took her infant, who was a newborn infant at the time, because that's how CPS works. So we're talking about black parents reaching out to physicians, hospitals, discipline for school situations, and then the tables are turned on them. This is what the Final Call article is talking about, and this is what we want to discuss. Now, what I want to also say is that black people, our children, are 77% more likely to be removed. I was reading in one article, and whereas we're 13% of the population, 25% of the foster care system. This is what they call disproportionality, where we are misrepresented based upon our actual numbers. You know, we're all the bad things, the prisons, the special education, we're represented higher in those negative systems. So this is a something that's telling us that this system is based upon white supremacy. So just kind of wanted to quickly read a paragraph from an advocate, and somebody is really getting some feedback now. Not sure whose phone is feeding back, but you may want to, we may want to look at that. And again, it could be mine, but I wanted to read this. Being taken outside of your family is not something that should be normalized. what one author describes as children being banned temporarily from their parents. Did you hear that? Banned. And this can be for months, and it could drag on for years. And at the same time, the life tenuing. And so these parents are missing important dates. They're missing accomplishments. The alienation grows between the parent and their child. The bitterness grows. The children are experiencing immense pain and loss, all based upon an accusation. And a lot of times these accusations are anonymous. And they're being made by people who are being encouraged to call. So I just wanted to let that sink in. This is what this feels like. So as the Final Call article said, family, they described it as family policing services. So I just kind of wanted to give everybody a chance to weigh in on what does that mean? Family policing services. What are we talking about here? And sister, whoever wants to begin, weigh in.
Okay, it's, this is Sister Marguerite. You know, it's very hard to know where to start. So that's just as good a place as any. It's family policing, and they use in the schools. And they're teaching your children in the schools to report things that occur in the home. So, and this is one of the things that occurred with my son, who was a single father raising five children. And, you know, they make your children feel like it's safe for them to report and say, you know, things. And his issue stemmed from the fact that he was banned from the video game because of his grades. So he, of course, being upset and thinking that the teacher was his friend and the school was his friend, went to school and voiced their discontent, voiced his discontent. And based on what he said, this is the grounds that they used to remove all his children. So one of the things that we have done since we have gotten the children back and have really deprogrammed them, because you have to deprogram them, we have had to teach them what they're dealing with and to keep their mouth shut when it comes to anything that happens in the home. These people are not your friends. They're looking for any chink in the armor about which. And single parents are targeted way more than anyone else. It's easier to take a child or take children when it's one parent household.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. So a family policing service. It starts, you know, like Sister Marguerite, thank you so much for that, ma'am. We're talking about unsubstantiated allegations a lot of times. And Brother Deshaun, can you kind of give us a legal input on what's a referral? What's an unsubstantiated allegation? I mean, it starts off as an allegation, but sometimes they're not substantiated.
Well, in the state of Tennessee, you're right when you say it's confidential. It's actually, if the worker were to disclose the name of the person who referred the case, it would actually be a crime. Because there's legally guaranteed anonymity for the person who makes the report. And essentially the report is made. The agency then, if the allegation is severe, the agency then has just a period of hours to get to the home and begin the investigation. So oftentimes the children are taken based on a very, very preliminary investigation. And once that investigation is done, the allegations are then written up and put before a judge without the knowledge of the other party. And of course, I'm only speaking for Tennessee, but the family won't have any knowledge that the petition has even been written up and it'll be granted. Usually when the department writes it up, it's granted without their knowledge, and they'll then have a 72-hour period in which to prepare themselves to begin a response, to come to court and respond to it. Usually that's not enough time to pay, you know, to prepare and pay for an attorney and all of those things, because the notice is very, very short on that. And the emotions are high. So most parties, from my experience, will come to court on the day of that initial hearing, having had no preparation and really being very emotional. They'll come to court and they'll say everything that under normal circumstances they would have had enough control not to say and give rise to the petition. Basically, they'll come to court and say things that incriminate themselves. They may not actually have done much wrong, but by the time they finish being, you know, finish testifying and being cross-examined without preparation, who knows what they may have said, and that will often lead to the children being in custody for a prolonged period of time and quite a bit of work being necessary to basically correct the circumstances and get the children out of the system. That's not procedurally, that's generally the case. It's not always the case that it's someone who hasn't done anything, but procedurally, that's generally how it'll happen. So the case will begin, the information will be gathered, and the person will usually have testified before anyone's had a chance to really advise them on how to maneuver. They'll be told they have a right to an attorney, but when your children are gone, emotions run high, and the thought of waiting to talk to somebody is usually far from the person's mind, I've found.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Deborah, Ms. Dr. Green, can you weigh in on that whole process, the unsubstantiated nature of these allegations that often lead to children, CPS, showing up at people's doors?
Yes, absolutely. Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for being a part of this. Thank you so much for being a part of this wonderful, wonderful discussion among the panelists. Well, first of all, yes, CPS can knock on your door anytime there's an allegation. CPS by law has to investigate that allegation. But very similar to what was just said, most of the allegations that come in through investigation are unsubstantiated, at least in the state of Texas and across the nation. I think that's pretty much the same. And I would say that in the state of Texas, 70 to 80% are unsubstantiated. And it is very difficult. If CPS knocks on your door and, you know, they present an authority for you, and oftentimes the police accompany them. However, one thing that was said, I would like to reiterate, is that you need to really not give out a lot of information. Just try to be calm in a situation that's uncalm, but try your best to be calm. And then only answer the questions that they ask. Don't volunteer the information. That's really, 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 really critical. And it's best to remain as silent as you can and ask a question. And then ask for someone else to be present, you know, or your attorney to be present with you. If you're asking to sign papers, you have the right to not sign those papers. You can say, you know, I need my attorney to look over them, whether you have an attorney or not. And if there's someone that near you, close to you, a family member that's more calm, you know, it's better to have someone with you than to face an allegation alone. But oftentimes, someone just simply knocks on your door. And when that happens, you need to ask for identification, because all CPS staff have identification card. Do your best to be polite. But even if that caseworker is accompanied by a police officer, you don't have to let them into your home. That's a misnomer. A lot of people think CPS knock on the door, you have to let them in. you do not. You can even say, hold on a second. You can talk to them outside of your door. You can say, hold on, let me get pencil and paper. So that's just, you know, one thing that, you know, people can do. And there's a number of other things that we can discuss later.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. Because as you were saying, whereas 80% may be found unsubstantiated cases, $284 million was spent in Texas in the investigative unit alone. So what we're saying is that really a lot of unsubstantiated allegations are being made. People are saying, you know, people are going to doctors, they're going to hospitals, they're going to schools, they're walking up and down the street. And as a result, somehow these anonymous reports are being made. So is there anybody else want to weigh in on how some of these reports are being made? Because is it always, do we think there's an overuse in our community on whether or not calling CPS is always the best thing for you and your family, or your loved one and their family?
Well, in my the case with my foster children and my grandchildren, I had several instances where it was the teacher who, in one instance, she called me to report that my son had done something, and this was at a time I had two foster children in my home, and when, you know, my child learned she had called me, and she turns around and asks him, are you afraid to go home? And, of course, he said, yes, I'm afraid to go home. You know, so she used that as a basis to file a CPS report. And my son was brought home by the police from the school, and the police, you know, told me what happened and said that the teacher had commented that he had come to school with his arm broken a few weeks before. So these people can wreak havoc in your life, these so-called mandatory reporters. Now, it just so happened the arm that he broke on campus after school. And I had to go take him, you know, to the emergency room. But see how easily, if there was no documentation as to how that incident had occurred, it could have really snowballed. So I immediately contacted the principal, who I had a relationship with because my children had been in the school for a while. And I was a hot as fish grease, as they say. And I wanted to meet with that teacher today. Well, I never got to meet with that teacher because she knew I was beyond pissed. And so she intervened and dealt with the issue and, you know, and corrected the teacher. I said, but you're going to put me in a position, if my child is burning your school down, don't call me. Okay, because you are also causing problems with my foster care license, you know, and other things, you know. So, and at the time, all my children were under 18, so they could have been removed as well. So these mandatory reporters can wreak havoc.
Even when it's harmless, you know, these are things like parents. I heard in a seminar, parents showing up late to pick up their children. Parents, you know, it being some very insignificant types of things that cause investigations to be open. As we see here, a woman's right to say, I don't want my child to take some B12 shot. And one of the things we want to dig into, because they say 77%, black children are 77% more likely to have their children removed or to be removed than other children. And so we want to talk about how this is part of the chattel slave system and how black people are, it's an outgrowth of how we are perceived as property. So, Sister Sandera, you're quiet. Why don't you weigh in on some of what you've seen with this policing service?
I'm going to sound like Sister Margarita. I'm almost as hot as history. but these stories stories, these stories, these stories. We can talk about the level of oppression and the, it made me think the term you used earlier, Pam, about family policing services. For whatever reason, going back to the beginning of the child welfare implementation, if you remember the history of it, it was all about trying to control someone else's presence or body. And at that point in the 1870s, it was about looking for guardians for children back in that era who were paupers and who needed to be protected or put in safe places. It again speaks to looking out and protecting, if that's what they were doing, others. But when it becomes policing, it becomes a lot more oppressive. So we really need to look at how we move from the slave mentality that you were talking about earlier, because at some point there's a belief system that our bodies don't belong to us. And therefore, we can victimize them, we can ostracize them, and of course we surely can report them. And therefore, we are put at a disadvantage in a lot of these systems. That's not only just the CPS system. You know, we could talk all night about the inequities that are going on in America when it relates to the black life. But because we're speaking up tonight on CPS practices, it started back in the 1870s of trying to protect. And at that time, it was white, because remember, black folks were in slavery. So they really weren't looking at protecting us. They were protecting white life.
And one thing, too,
into the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And one thing to look at, too, white people or Europeans have never been keen on child protective services, okay? They have always had issues with child labor and child labor laws.
Yes.
So, you know, this is part of their history, you know, abusing children. And it was interesting to look at the history, and people think I just have a thing for Hillary Clinton, which I can't stand, but I just know a lot about her history. And she was behind wrapping up this CAPTA, you know, and the Republicans who, you know, she needed to get this thing through, they told her, but you got to change it from orphanages, which what Hillary wanted. She was looking to, you know, to have orphanages for these children. And they said, you have to change it to adoption. So really what we're looking at, and I know you're going to get to it eventually, Sister Pam, our children being taken out of our communities and really put in orphanages.
And she's referencing the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And I know with the Association
1994.
Of Black Social Workers, that's one of the legislations that you all are trying to get reformed. Because
trying to repeal, yes, with the MEPA, which if you're familiar with that one, the Multi-Placement Ethnic Act. And that's been something we want to repeal, too. Our children need to be in our family, in our community, whether it be blood-level intervention support or fix-it kin, if you're not familiar with that term. But our community is able and is capable of protecting and meeting the needs of our children. And if that was a belief system that a lot of us had, I would think we would really be able to minimize a lot of this CPS intervention. Because we talked earlier about the lack of having the village that we used to have back in our earlier lives. But we don't have the village to the same level, and we need to increase that level of intervention again and get our children into a position that they have safe places and decent families that they can depend on.
Right, because as you said, safe places, right now in Texas, they are actually putting children in hotels, storing children in CPS offices. I think a couple of months ago, the governor outlawed that. But they're picking up so many children it's like, well, why don't you leave these children in their homes and make these homes safer? And I think as both you and Miss Sister Marguerite were saying, there are some policies that are behind that motivate the picking up and the removal of black children. And we know racism is at its core. As Sister Marguerite said, we were enslaved in the 1870s and we were free labor. So this whole thing goes back to the free labor system, because we know that children who are in foster care tend to go to prison at higher levels. Children that are in foster care end up being having money on their heads, because families that foster them, a lot of times they are white families, they are actually getting paid substantial funds. And I think that's what that MEPA, if you can just reiterate that, Sister Sandera, MEPA, and that's about what? That's about, what is that about? Transracial adoption, right?
That transracial adoption intervention, that was a law that white America instilled or put out back in 74. I'm going to look at my dates here. But it also was there to help expedite the movement of our children out of our communities and out of our families. And they eliminated the barrier of racial as well as cultural aspect in putting children in a non-black home. And they eliminated that and told the communities and those institutions that they could no longer use those levels to intervene and place children. So they removed race as well as culture and said that children could be placed in any environment. And that was how a lot of our children were pushed out of our communities into white homes. And I believe, unfortunately, I think we're going to go back to that now with this adoption and the abortion right law and trying to repeal Roe v. Wade. I think that's another way for white America to try to find babies. Because they're going to force these young girls to have to carry these babies all the way to term. But, of course, they're going to put them in adoption. So that's another strategy to keep children in white homes, that's because they're not having them. We talked about that earlier in another call we had, that white America's not having babies like they used to.
Right.
So
and we know
that they can't have babies. Uh-huh.
Right. And so, you know, many of us believe that abortion is also a form of genocide. So I think those things about taking control of families and taking away individual rights, that's something we all can agree on. And I know what Sister Marguerite was saying, during this Hillary Clinton, you know, part of that legislation that was being pushed,
that era,
that was that was taking off the term, you know, putting, making it sound nice, you know, putting some kind of pleasant standing on a
term,
evil policy, which ended up, one of the things it ended up doing was shortening the time frame for which children and families have before their rights are terminated. And we need to talk about that, because the next session we want to talk about is from that article, the Final Calls article, but we want to talk about wolves and sheep's clothing. Wolf and sheep's clothing. And this is something that state agencies, these families, these advocates are saying, that they appear they appear like sheep, but they really are wolves. And that 15-month deadline is one of the things that's really causing a lot of people's rights to be terminated. I know Brother Deshaun and I were talking about it, because it really, once they have your children, you know, and you're coming from a situation where maybe there were some problems in the home, that may not be enough time for you to really meet all these hoops that they're forcing people to jump over. And so then they're using that to justify, this is why we're going to terminate your rights.
And in addition, they're putting obstacles in the parents' way.
Mm-hmm.
And
we're going to talk about
son,
that.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to talk about that. Go ahead. Yes, ma'am.
But they and they changed the goalposts. Those are good strategies they did to make sure you don't make that deadline.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
But again,
yes,
that only speaks to just the wool and cheap clothing concept that you were speaking of, Pam. They present themselves as protectors. They present themselves as the legal finaglers of the law. We know what's bad for children. We know what their families need. And therefore, we are going to do the protective role for the country because obviously you can't do it. And that's the mindset.
And the one thing. The one thing that happened to my family was when we went to the visit to see the children for the first time, there was a new caseworker there. There was a new woman there. It wasn't the one who had taken them. And she was distancing herself. Well, I didn't have anything to do with it. And, you know, trying to make, just trying to disarm us as far as what her job was. And I reminded her, I said, but you get to pay from the same people she gets paid from. So to me, you're one and the same. Make no mistake about it. And so they do these little tactics to disarm you.
Right.
And so that's a good point.
She's still there to do the negative, or she's still there to do the oppressive behavior. So she presents herself as a sheep, but she is really one of the wolves in that system.
That's right.
So we have to be really cognizant of that.
Let's say this. Let me get a minute in here. So, look, I knew this was going to be a heated conversation, and so we want any callers to actually, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number one to get into the queue. And I want to hear from Deborah if Deborah's line is open. I also want to hear from Brother Deshaun, because as they're describing how this conflict, I think it's a conflict where, you know, CPS says we're a protective agency, but perhaps that's not the case. And so is there anybody
like
want to comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd like to comment, and both Sister Marguerite and Sister Sandera are right on target, but I wanted us to remember that none of these systems are designed for us, not the education system, not the mental health system, not the health system, none of those systems. And so when you think about referrals that come into CPS, most of the referrals come from the education system and educators. Mm-hmm. They exactly what happened. They see something, they hear something, and then they call in a CPS referral. The other place is the hospital system. You know, for example, there was a child welfare study that hospitalized Black and Hispanic children were 5 times more likely to be evaluated for child abuse and 3 times more likely to be reported than white children hospitalized for exactly the same injuries. So the issue is that once they're in the system, they stay longer without family reunification. The other thing is that someone had mentioned the prison system. And I think that we need to talk a little bit about that, because the bigger picture is that these kids are being funneled through, even through the prison system. That makes sense to me, because 1 out of 3 African-American males will be incarcerated in his lifetime. That's according to data that we can look at right now. And there, of course, we all know from, you know, there's statistics that goes children being pushed into the prison system from the foster care system. 50%, for example, of foster children in foster care system are Black or Latino. You know, of the foster care youth entering the system in the juvenile justice system, most of them, 30%, are placement-related behavioral type of cases. 25% of young people leaving foster care will be incarcerated within a few years after they turn 18. And 50% of young people leaving foster care will be unemployed within a few years. 70% to 80% of the inmates are individuals who are former foster care youth. So when we think about that, the bigger picture of incarceration from these systems. That's one reason why I decided to get a doctorate in education after being in CPS over 35 years, because I wanted to look more deeply into the system. So in my opinion, the bigger picture is that our children are being funneled and used for the prison system, or and oftentimes kids end up on the street, and then they're being sex trafficked. So we have to look at those issues too. And all of the data that shows kids that are aging out of care tells us that children would be better off if they were left in their own home rather than aging out of care, because CPS is not a good parent. So what does that mean? Most of the removal did not have to occur. The kids would have been better off in the home.
Right. And the thing to that, Deborah, when you speak about CPS, it's basically tearing families apart, because our children get stuck in these systems. If they cannot get back to their families of origin, or they linger in what we call a permanency status, they can age out, as we call it, because that's the term used, turning 18. But they end up going to seek families even then. I used to supervise the adolescent unit for the state, and I only had the teenagers from 13 to 18. And they would all be in permanent foster homes all those years. Families would be. And at the end, at 18, they would end up finding those families and going back to live with them. So we do not have good parents. CPS, yeah. I say we, because I was a 36-year employee for years. But that is not
right.
The system that we should be building
and
for our
one
children.
Of the things, yes, and that system changes your child. And I have seen how it changes them. They come back differently. One of the things, we were not allowed to see our grandchildren for like 3 months. And when I saw my granddaughter, she said, "Grandma, I thought you were dead." So this is what the trauma they put on the children. It's as if their family group died. They want you totally cut off and disconnected, and they want to wear you down where you don't come back for the children.
And that's, again, about the oppressiveness of that system, Sister Marguerite. That's all it's about, is destroying our family.
Yeah.
System building. So, yes, we have to definitely look at that and build our families up before they get to the point to be in the CPS system, because it's devastating. It is overwhelming and devastating, not only for the child, but look at the family. Look at the extended family, the relatives, extended family, aunts, uncles. They don't get to see their families in a comfortable environment again until if they stay in that system forever, or if they end up getting terminated on. They may never see him again.
And so that, before we go to Brother, Deshaun, because I want him to share some of the legal sides as a lawyer, but I wanted to, because Deborah mentioned the educational system, and also, Sister Sandera, you talked about the destruction of the family. So I want to quote from the article, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. He said, "The destruction of the black family is a sin of huge proportion. Therefore, the effort to rebuild the family must be aided by those who destroyed the family, and the responsibility of helping must be accepted by the generations that have benefited from the institutional slavery and the destruction of our families." So this is one of the things we're talking about. And then also I wanted to bring up another quote from the minister, and it's in an article called "Who is Our Natural Enemy? Who is the natural enemy of the original man?" And it's also in this September 21st final call. But in this article, he's talking about how we live in colonies. See, the type of predatory targeting of our families and the removals of our families and the, you know, children from our families, and our powerlessness to really stop it, and our condition that they find, you know, us in sometimes, which is resulting from some of the crimes that have been committed against us, it has made us live in colonies where we don't control a lot. And so, as the minister said, he says, so we have to break up the colonial status of the black community. He said, you can't make this community a decent place to live unless we control the education. The education is part of the trick. And if the education were right for us, we wouldn't lead in dropouts. You know, it's not
right.
an appealing education because they're educating us. And the base idea of the education is white supremacy. He said, you need an education that will make you love you, that will make you see what you have contributed to the onward march of civilization. So I think that's really an important, you know, something we see it missing in what we're dealing with this attack and this genocidal plot to destroy the black family, and it's coming through these carceral systems. And so, Brother Deshaun, I wanted you to talk to us a bit about what some of these cases are looking like in court. What are some of the things that you're having to deal with in you know, defending your parents? And do you find the need to nurture your clients sometimes, giving them knowledge as to how to get out of these traps?
I would say that anybody who's had their children taken by CPS definitely needs counsel, because maneuvering through that system, and we have to remember that it is in fact the system. One of the sisters mentioned that they had a new worker, and that worker was trying to distance herself from the deeds of the previous. We have to remember that it really is a system, and it's set up for just that. The person who does the investigation is not the person who deals with the family. And that's not the person who deals with the case when it's getting ready for adoption. It's all
right.
compartmentalized for a reason, because one of them, the person who you met the second time, may have a whole different opinion. But once the state makes its decision, she's stuck following that decision. She can't deviate from the state's position, although she can do some minor things to assist you. And so maneuvering through that system is a minefield, and it's one where emotion is the most dangerous thing. And oftentimes I end up having to shepherd my clients through, mostly because of emotion. This is their child. This is the most important thing in their life. And there's someone else making these decisions and that person doesn't know the whole story. And it can be a true nightmare. So yes, I often have to calm my clients down. I have to tell them, you know, we can't move in that direction right now. We have to wait until it's a case of strategy. But all you can see in that moment is that you're being mistreated. And oftentimes people are. One of the parties made a statement that, you know, a lot of this comes from schools and hospitals. But a lot like when the police are called, many times I've found that it's a family member or a third party
mm-hmm.
who's got a problem with the family who will make this report. And because the reporting is completely confidential, you know, that person who felt like they were snubbed can take it out on the family by just calling CPS.
Mm.
And they show up at the door and they're proceeding as though this is correct and trying to do an investigation to determine, you know, is this child in immediate risk of this thing that may actually not be true at all. But defending yourself against the negative is always, and so, yes, I regularly have to parent my clients through this circumstance. And I regularly have to figure out what's really going on in order to help them. If if I have somebody who the truth of the matter is they just have a small problem that they really need to deal with, but they're overcompensating, trying to hide it, then that can mess up the whole work. So it's a very vulnerable place for a parent, and it's not something you want to do alone, because there are many parties involved with many different agendas. You know, as we were talking earlier, there's the attorney who's supposed to represent the child. And while CPS can be a minefield, the party who's supposed to represent the child can often be the most dangerous party. Because whatever their biases are, they can be ever so biased, but because they represent the child, they're the party who the judge is going to listen to the most. They're the person who has the most say in the case, because they're supposed to be neutral, but very few of them are. So if they've made a quick decision because somebody seems wealthier than someone else, or because their parent, something special about the foster parent, then this case can go from something that would have been very simple to something that drags on past those deadlines that were discussed. It can be those additional parties just make it even more difficult to get your children back. And so the one thing I can say is that emotion is the enemy of trying to resolve this, and patience and trying to think through it rationally can help a lot.
So that's really important. I wanted to say on that point, because we talked about that earlier, Brother Deshaun and I, and federal lawsuits are another area, because what he's describing, we're talking about some illegalities here where people who are being appointed and paid state funds are using their own biases and their own prejudices to impede you and your child's reunification. We're really talking about some illegalities here when police officers who don't have probable cause, or caseworkers who may, you know, be acting with flimsy to no evidence, have the ability to terminate or cause your rights to your child to be terminated on much less than what's required in criminal court. So there are some unconstitutional problems here. But I wanted to quote myself from the article in Final Call, because what he just said is what we were talking about. Once in the system, the parents are confronted with two problems. They are made to jump through hoops, having to take different classes. It's a money-making machine. The children are appointed white attorneys called guardian ad litem, who allegedly represent the best interests of the child and find every reason under the sun not to return the child to their family. So you have three attorneys involved. You know, the parent's attorney, who's almost always the court-appointed attorney sometimes, and they're overwhelmed, the child's attorney, and then a state who represents CPS, who is CPS is supposed to want to help you because they see you having problems, but then they have an attorney that will, you know, prosecute it to try to get your rights terminated. Plus, it's a really big mess. And what Brother Deshaun just said about the ad litem attorney, I want us all to really think about that, because what you're having are these courts appointing people who step into the shoes of the parents. So once your child is taken into custody, you can't take the child home. You can't decide what the child eats anymore. You can't make health decisions for the child. You really can, you know, you can only see them based upon the schedules that they give to you. And usually all of this is kind of dealt with through some attorney for your child, and your child has really no say in it other than this attorney who is now representing your child against you and being paid to do so. So I think that's one of the most problematic areas of this. This is what I've seen. So I just kind of thank you so much, Brother Deshaun, for that. Did you want to add any more to that particular area or quandary? I know you know we talked before because you actually were a attorney for Children's Protective Services, and I think you living in a primarily blacker jurisdiction, you've kind of seen maybe where you do have black caseworkers, people may be a little more responsible to the needs of black families. But when it comes to how they deal with white families, have you seen any differences with how the system is more lenient, perhaps, than when it comes to the harsh mentality of with white black families? Yes, sir.
Almost definitely. When most definitely, because a lot of it comes down to people's opinion about the party. And so I've had a number of cases where, you know, the caseworker was just a lot more understanding when it was a white family, or the guardian ad litem was a lot more understanding, because all of these are case by case. So you may have two people with very same circumstances, but in one case they're just not fighting as hard. That person's going to get their children back a whole lot faster. And it is very true that the race of the person makes a big difference because of people's biases. And that's just the reality of what we deal with every day. My clients, we just going to have to fight harder because someone's right. going to view them as being less capable of turning around. And
yes,
a lot of it does come down to people's opinions about the family.
Yes, sir. Mm. Yes, sir. That's right. Mm. And even to the point of when you see some of these young mothers and fathers struggling to get their children back and struggling to meet the thresholds that now this system of white supremacy who's holding their children is telling them, well, this is what you need to do. Oftentimes, you know, they are still not giving the children back, even after they've jumped over the hoops. This is what we're seeing in Texas. So then we see these hotels holding children because they've removed so many children and foster care is so full. Well, perhaps, as Dr. Green said, if you would stop removing so many children, all of this overcrowding would not be going on. And again, I think the article in the final call is showing us just how easy it is to tear families apart on unsubstantiated allegations or bias or cultural differences. But we wanted to, because we're down, and I think the conversation is going well, and I wanted to talk about how important is the village concept in working with families in crisis. And so we were talking about what we do, why I brought, you know, for this show, everybody graciously accepted, but we brought social workers, we brought doctors, we brought community parents, you know, we brought our attorneys. And why is that perhaps something that can really help that particular way of thought? And I'm going to take this call real fast. We have a call, and I'm going to go ahead and open up the line while I guess our producer is actually checking it. But I can go ahead and open up this line. Okay. Yes, caller ending in 646. Caller, do you have a question or a comment? Your line is open.
Yes. Assalamu alaikum. I had a comment.
Yes, sir. Well, like salam, sir.
Yeah, I've had, instance. My name is Stefan Muhammad Singh. I'm in Arizona, and I've had running with DCS. Definitely in regards to changing the goalposts, that happened often in my case when I was fighting for my children. And even if, you know, if anybody calls on you for whatever reason, maybe they thought that you were yelling at your child or something like that more than you should have, that gets marked down. And, you know, you ask, is this going to be used against me in the future? You know, even if it's not substantiated, they tell you no, but it's a lie. Because I've had meetings where they'll be like, oh, well, this incident was brought up against you. But, yeah, you don't get to fight as far as context, especially, like, when you're in a court and the judge looks at you as, like, just another number. I mean, I've been talked to, like, I had, you know, dirt on my face, for lack of a better word. But and then it was only when we brought somebody who was a representative of the media to one of my court cases that I was allowed to actually speak, because my representative was garbage. So the most exposure he got to my cases was 5 minutes before, you know, I was due to go into court, and then he's asking me, trying to catch up in 5 minutes on everything that's been happening since the last court date. You know, it's just difficult. They put you in a bad situation when you're a parent, because I was a single parent and I was working. And it's like I have to take up time for these court cases. And now because I have a case with DCS, I also have a criminal case. So I got to take off days for that case. And then it just ends up spiraling, you know, because your job, you tell them of the situation. It's basically you're guilty and you have to work like hell to prove your innocence. And, you know, fortunately, we were able to, you know, keep the truth right there in their face. They will openly lie on you in court, and it's legal. We've had instances where things will come about, and we're just looking around in amazement, like, where did this come from? They stopped my visits because my children would tell me what was actually going on in the group homes. They were suffering all types of abuses that they have never come in contact with under my care. And when we started reporting that, they started making up allegations. Oh, you beat your children at one of the visits. And I'm like, so one thing that will save you if you're dealing with these people, you have to know your rights. You have to know what can and can't go on. And I knew that anywhere I went, that parental advocate was supposed to be there during my visits. So I'm asking for, where's the transcripts? Oh, we will present them at the next court case. Next court case comes. There's no transcripts of the visit. Because we asking for this. Okay, this has to be documented. Where was it? It was never done because we were causing trouble. And one thing that a sister had told me that worked for DCS, she was like, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So if you don't say nothing, you're going to be passed over. And I was like, I'm not finna be the squeaky wheel. I'm finna let them know I have a voice. My mother was involved as well. And we just stayed on them. If any, we had heard a report from the children, you can believe it was an email being sent. So, you know, they do all kind of nefarious things to block you off from your children. I had lost my job at one time, and they told my children. Sir. And I'm just like, now my daughter's asking me, Daddy, are you okay? Like, I'm worried about you. And I checked them. I'm like, why do y'all do that? Because that's not my children's business. It's not their job to worry about Daddy. I'm going to be okay, but they do all kinds of nefarious things. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for that call, sir. Because as he's saying, this is an area of law where there are few checks and balances. Once the child is taken, there are no real checks and balances that can ensure that you're getting fair treatment in the court, such as he mentioned, making sure you have a court reporter. He mentioned making sure you send emails, but all of this you're having to do while they are holding your children captive. And, you know, so I think if there's a saying such as cruel and unusual punishment, this would fit. When there's no due process, there's one author said there's no effective supervision of courtroom behavior. And then there are just these long gaps. As the brother said, you know, you're just having all this time between your next court date, and then they're holding your children during this time, feeding them and telling you, giving you reports, sometimes very unsubstantiated allegations. And so I know we're down to, we're coming to the end. And again, if anybody has a question or a comment, please press the number 1 to get in the host queue.
I wanted to come down to again, what solutions do we see that by coming together? Can we help to alleviate this particular system's ravaging effect? I mean, if anything, this is a separation issue. This is why we must separate. This is why we must put our children into their own schools. You know, this is why midwives are so important. This is why knowledge and education and support of those in our community that need our help is so very important. So,
One of the important things for parents.
Go ahead, Sister Marguerite.
Okay, one of the important things for parents who are in it right now is for you to educate yourself as to what's going on, because that will help ease your breath. When you understand, you know, it ain't that you're a bad parent. It ain't that you're in a system that has to be saved. And unfortunately, we're the few. So, and the next thing is to document. Every time they said something, we wrote it down and we sent it to them. Every time they did something, we wrote it down and sent it to them. You know, so they couldn't get around. They couldn't really get in court and lie because we had documentation as to what they said. You know, so, and then get you a parent advocate. Find a local organizing group and get you an advocate to help walk you through this process.
Talk about that. Sandera, did you want to chime in on that? And again,
I just wanted to speak pretty much what Marguerite was leaning toward, but I go back to the old concept of the village and that we definitely need to have persons who are supportive, be that family, be that religious entities, be that advocates, as she was speaking of, but we need more than just ourselves to try to absorb all of the trauma and all of the devastating experiences, because we speaking of wolves and sheep clothing, that's what they're going to do, and it's very limited times, as you're speaking of, Brother Deshaun, is that you go into the court and it's quick. You go in and you may do most of your work in the hallway.
And as
you get to the judge, you can't even really speak. You have to really let your attorney speak for you. But you may not even get into court, but every, what, six weeks to 2 months, every 90 days or whatever that's about, you can't do any serious rehabilitation with the courts at that point. You not to do your rehabilitation outside of the court.
Yeah, and I want you to talk about that more, Sister Sandera, because, again, oftentimes they may have your child in foster care, but there are ways such as kinship that potentially, you know, parents can do something. So you can explain that. But I'm going to open up the mic as well for Sister Kiana, who's another attorney that we have who has graciously called in. Sister Kiana. I open your mic, Sister Kiana. Waalaikum salam, ma'am. How are you? Right on time.
I am good. I mean, yeah, I am, because I really just wanted to join in the conversation when she said something about the village. I went right into kinship placements and kinship care being the first option. I think that we should really strongly consider in making sure that we have appropriate placements for our children, and that does also take away some of the anxiety, you know, while a parent is dealing with this process and the system, to know that your child is with someone that you're connected to, and someone that you know. And so that whole concept about the village is very important that we get back into that mindset. And just to say, as far as the system is concerned, the system does not support relative placements. They don't support, from my experience, kinship placement as much as they do these foster homes. And we know this is a money-making machine, and they are definitely able to get more funding for children with different levels of care. So to place a child in a residential treatment center or a specialized home or something like that, then the agency gets more funding for those types of placements. But what we see is that people have not really reached out to their community to try to ensure that, you know, this does not happen. And when they do, it is very difficult. I'm not going to suggest that it's not going to be an uphill battle in trying to secure some kinship placement, but I think it's worth the fight, really, on behalf of our children and our community, that we make them look at each and every person that we can think of in our circle that could possibly help secure our children while we're fighting the real fight with Child Protective Services. So I just wanted to add that in the conversation.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you so much, Sister Kiana. And what she, one of the things she's saying, I think, is make sure you get that list of names, telephone numbers, addresses, try to get the people who don't have records or criminal backgrounds, and, you know, and make sure you get those lists out there early so they can start doing these background checks on your relatives, because, you know, the system operates to say that that's the only way they're going to let the children go to your relative, if they deem that your relative is suitable a lot of times. I mean, the whole thing is a travesty. Brother Deshaun, did you want to add anything to that? Because I know you had spoken about some of the incentives and how these agencies are, you know, racking up successes, money, public opinion, and how that motivates really how they are taking our children and how they're operating. But
The brother who called in, when he said that he brought someone from the media, if you have a sympathetic person from the media to hear your case, the two things that I found that move DCS are federal funds and public opinion. So if you can get public opinion on your side, you have just made a major step. But when you talked about a village, I agree with that wholeheartedly, because you're not going up against one person when the state has your child. You're going up against the system. You can develop a team, have a lawyer, have somebody who understands something about social work, have a list of relatives who are sufficient. And even if it's not a relative, kinship can also include family friends. So have a team together. If you're part of a church, have a minister. You know, the more people you can show as part of your team who can bring some benefit to this, the safer you are, because then they're not just hearing from you. They're having to deal with all of these people who have some say. But only get the people who you know are A, on your side, and people who are rational. People who are extremely emotional are not going to help you in this. People who are just telling you that everything you're doing is right are not going to help you. And be honest with your people about the things you have to work on, so that you can work on it, so that someone helps hold you accountable, so that you can resolve the problem. But never go into this with the position that I've got everything together. We've all got something to work on. And if there's a real problem there, you have to be honest with yourself and work on that problem. But have a team.
Yes,
that
sir.
Would be my position.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Okay. And I'm going to open up Dr. Green's Dr. Green, I'm opening your mic again, because as he was saying, you know, so having this team prior to getting into trouble, when the family is in crisis, I think that's something that Sister Sandera can talk about. Dr. Green, I know your phone is having a little bit of a background issue, so I don't know if you wanted to weigh in at this point.
on any subject. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, yes, I really would. I really do believe that it, in addition to everything else that's been said, that it's important that we have more Black foster homes as well. The importance of having a team is really, really critical because the lens in which our families are being viewed or lenses in which they don't believe that we have any value at all. And so if we don't have value, then our children cannot have value. And also I want to point out that Child Protective Services, especially in an investigation, the whole idea is to not look at protection of the family. It's not about preservation of the family. It is mm-hmm. about protection of the child. And I think that's really important. And so how the families or the children are being viewed is really, really critical. And I want to read just a quick, very short excerpt from a poem that I really like. It's by Nikki, it's called Nikki Rosa, and it's from Nikki Giovanni. And she says, "And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me because they never can understand that Black love is Black wealth, and they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy." And so I think that, again, and we need to make sure that we preserve our Black families.
Right. That's beautiful. Because as you say, as they, even though they say their mantra is that they want to protect Black children, but we know that the condition of Black children and the genocide and the shooting down of our people and the false arresting of our people and the negative education of our children and just the whole everything that has we've experienced since bringing here, it doesn't speak to that. So you have to also say that, as you said, anybody that refuses to respect the familial bonds between parents and children, the blood line, you know, we have to question whether or not they really are trying to protect children or whether or not this is a genocidal, you know, system that is based in white supremacy, which is what we know. So we're down, and I wanted Sister Sandera to say something. Sister Deborah, I'm going to go ahead and quiet, mute your mic real fast, and yeah. And so, Sister Marguerite, I'm going to open yours as well. But go ahead, Sister Sandera, if you can tell us about Coalition for the Preservation of the Black Family and tell us just some of how working together with social workers and community activists and experts, you know,
right.
has really shown some progress
right.
in helping
Thank
to,
you,
to help families. Yes, ma'am.
I'm a partner in this initiative that Sister Pam just spoke about. It's called the Coalition for the Preservation of the Black Family. And we started this probably a good 5 years ago where we continue to see the gaps and the flaws in Child Protective Services placements. And we wanted to intervene and make sure that our children went into relative placement, kinship placements, fictive kin. And that means you don't have to be blood. But we wanted our children out of the foster care system. And being I have been in it for many, many years, as long as Sister Deborah, she has as well. We saw the flaws, and we knew that the system was not there, and it was not in the best interest of our children to linger in foster care. So the Coalition for the Family was created. We are an advocacy group. It is a partnership with attorneys, with social workers, with psychologists, all pro bono, and we really work to advocate for the least of these, as the scripture would say, but we often want to make sure that our clients or our families that don't have the resources, that they have someone to advocate for them. So we would sit in court with them. We'll go with them. We'll do staffings with them. We'll help with building strength-based
knowledge for them, and we want to help them work on that emotional energy, as you talked about, Brother Deshaun. We need to make sure that it stays even and balanced, and we try to do some modeling with them so that they will be in a good place when they go before the judge and before the court. And we want to make sure that they are seeing the growth in our clients and in our families, and we want them to operate out of knowledge and being informed, not out of emotionality.
Yes.
So that group has been around for about, like I say, 5 years, and the phone number for that, in case anyone is interested, is
713-588-5885. And so, yeah, because we're out of time, and we're going to do closing, but thank you for that. And we're actually encouraging others in other cities to build those type of coalitions as well, because this is an area where social work is really a key to dealing with our families, as well as the legal advocacy. So I would like to thank Brother Deshaun for coming on. Sister Marguerite, I'm going to open up your mic again. Sister Marguerite?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. And so closing, thank you all so much for coming on. We're down to 3 minutes. Does anybody have any closing comments and as we end this topic?
Well, I would just push for people to join your organization, which I'm going to do because I think I'm going to be here a while, but also to educate yourself as just to what is going on, what is being done to our children in these situations. Nothing is being done for them, but we need to do something before, you know, a lot of them are lost. They're getting lost every day, but we can do something.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you so much for that. And Brother Deshaun, again, we're down to 2 minutes. I want to thank you so much, Brother Attorney, for coming on. Did you have anything you'd like to say? How can people get in contact with you?
Yeah. I would say thank you, sister, because the work you're doing is beautiful. And we need to basically try and duplicate this organization that you have in all of our cities, because that's what we need is resources like that. And if someone needs to get in touch with me, my number is 901-205-9360. That's 901-205-9360. But the work that you're doing is immeasurable, and we need to duplicate that.
Yes, sir. All praises are due to Allah. Thank you. And I just wanted to say that it's very important. I always say that possession is 9/10 of the law. And what I mean by that when it comes to our children is that keeping your children close, you know, keeping your children in environments that you have more control of, making sure that your children are within arm's reach. Homeschooling has grown immeasurably. Private schools that are really favorable to your children's educational needs are very important too. But we need to keep our children closer. And if you see others who need help, maybe, you know, babysitting or maybe assisting, educating, as Sister Marguerite said, poor mothers or young mothers and fathers onto how to avoid this system is a very good strategy, because as we become more educated, we can fight for our liberation. So thank you for listening to A Time for Justice. To hear previous shows, you can log on to blogtalkradio.com. We invite you to listen to the Elevated Places Ask Dr. Ava on Thursday, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team. I would like to thank Sister Samaya Muhammad, the executive producer on this show, Sister Rona, Brother Terrence, of course, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, Sister Donna Muhammad. And thank you all for listening and tuning in. Please tune in next week for more informative discussions. Remember, we are seeking a educated format so our people can see justice
based on the knowledge and information that we're bringing. Assalamu alaikum, and have a good evening.
Good night.
Good night.